I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The high priority countries right now for us are South Sudan, Burundi, and Rwanda.
That's Patsy Nakel, Chief of Communications for UNICEF's Africa Service Unit. Details coming up also. A car bombing in the Somali capital has killed at least 17 people, and British Airways has cancelled flights to Egypt for a week, citing security concerns. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, hospital officials say a car bombing in the Somali capital killed at least 17 people and injured 28 others today. The extremist Al-Shabaab group claimed the responsibility. The suspected suicide bomber detonated his vehicle near a hotel close to Mogadishu's busy K4 junction, damaging nearby buildings and setting cars on fire. Witnesses told the VOA Somali service that the vehicle was turned back from a security checkpoint that leads to Eden Abdulli International Airport. The explosion came just 4 days after a senior Al-Shabaab intelligence officer was killed in an apparent U.S. airstrike near the town of Konobaro. Several days earlier, 26 people were killed and 56 injured in a 12-hour attack by Al-Shabaab on a popular hotel in the southern port city of Kismayu. As aid agencies and medical experts in the Democratic Republic of Congo struggle to contain a year-long Ebola outbreak in the country's eastern region, neighboring countries are working to make sure the disease doesn't cross borders. There is a particular concern about the ability of South Sudan, Burundi, and Rwanda to fight the disease. UNICEF is one of the agencies at the forefront of this effort. Patsy Nakel is the Chief of Communications for UNICEF's Africa Service Unit. Today, she spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about the UN Children's Organization's work.
So the Ebola cases in Uganda, for one, have demonstrated that the risk of Ebola spreading beyond DRC obviously remains very high. Now, we have the situation in the DRC today that continues to report 10 to 15 suspected cases per day. And this is including health worker infections as well as community deaths. And many of these contacts are still being traced, and some of them are untraced. So while response efforts inside DRC, of course, need to be redoubled, preparedness efforts in high-risk neighboring countries are also urgently being stepped up, and this is mainly to the east for now. And the quick and very effective response in Uganda really demonstrates the importance of investing in this preparedness. Now, we have a situation in Uganda where, of course, the government there is quite familiar with responding to Ebola from previous times, as well as other hemorrhagic diseases, of course. So this strong government leadership has really been extremely important and effective. The same is not true for the other countries. Like the high priority countries right now for us are South Sudan, Burundi, and Rwanda.
What are you doing in those high priority countries?
So, for instance, I can give you an example of what's happening in South Sudan, which is a country that already has a large humanitarian infrastructure, which now, of course, has been used also to respond and do preparedness work around Ebola. Since the beginning of the year, we have, for instance, UNICEF has been working with local humanitarian actors and with the local government in order to raise awareness around Ebola and how it is contained, how to contain it, how to respond to it. Almost half a million people have already been reached with group work and group communication, and they have been, we've trained local frontline workers in these kinds of messaging. We work around water and sanitation and hygiene, both in health units and also in high-risk sort of border areas. And these are the kind of things that we work in the other countries as well.
Right. Now, I mean, what is being done specifically to protect children from this outbreak?
Yes, so one of the pillars that UNICEF works around is, for instance, psychosocial support, right? So particularly children that have been affected by the disease, whether directly themselves, and we know, sadly, with this outbreak, there is a higher level of infection among children. There's about 30% as opposed to previous outbreaks where only 20% of the of those affected were children. Now it's higher. And many of those children that are affected are below the age of five. So first of all, it comes down to sensitizing families and parents to understand what the symptoms are, but also frontline workers, also health workers, community workers, and pediatricians. And borderline personnel as well. We offer hand washing units, specialized hand washing units that we place in schools and in health centers as well.
What does the funding situation look like?
Well, unfortunately, we would still need about $80 million just to reach a minimum preparedness in the at-risk countries, which are Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda, and South Sudan. Now, that's a pretty large sum of money, but this is an international emergency, and everybody should be concerned about doing at least the minimum in order to protect not only the people of those countries, but elsewhere as well. So it's incumbent on the international community to step up at this stage, and we are really prepared to ramp up our response, and we just need the international community to help us do that.
That was Patsy Nakel with UNICEF in Johannesburg. She was speaking with VOA's Kate Bond-Dawson. The World Health Organization last week declared the outbreak a public health emergency of international concern after at least three patients crossed into Uganda and a case was found in the city of Goma in the DRC. The declaration aims to ramp up international funding and support to fight the outbreak, which has killed more than about 1,700 people. Kenyan police arrested Finance Minister Henry Rotich and other Treasury officials, charging them with corruption and fraud. They are the highest targets netted so far in the government's anti-graft campaign. Director of Public Prosecution Nuruddin Haji said the case involves two major dam projects in the Western Rift Valley region that were part of the president's $25 billion plan for infrastructure improvement. Haji said the officials flouted all procurement rules in ways that affected the country's public debt. Costs of the project expanded and the contract was awarded to Italian firm CMC di Ravenna, even though it had been forced into liquidation and failed to complete three other dam projects. The Harvard-trained Rotich has been at the Treasury for 6 years. He and CMC have denied any wrongdoing. Cameroon says armed separatists are occupying more than 50 schools in its Western English-speaking regions. The alleged occupation could complicate government plans to restart education in the regions in September. Moki Edwin Kinzaka reports from Bamenda, northwestern Cameroon.
Cameroon authorities say separatist fighters have taken over scores of schools in the English-speaking northwest region, using them for training and to hide from the military. Cameroon's basic education chief for the northwest region, Wilfred Wembeng Dong, spoke to reporters on Sunday.
We have about 48 schools that have been destroyed in our system and another 53 schools that are occupied presently. As regards our teachers, we are doubting the whereabouts of more than 3,000 teachers for the schools that are not going.
Ndong said most of the missing teachers probably escaped to safer areas in French-speaking regions or are hiding in the bush. He said school attendance in the region has dropped from 422,000 in 2017 to 5,500 this year, and is mostly in safer towns like Bamenda and Kambe. Cameroon separatists in social media posts denied they are occupying the schools, but said they were deployed to areas prone to military attacks. The Anglophone rebels have attacked numerous schools over the past 2 years, in some cases abducting teachers and students. The commander of government troops in the northwest, General Robinson Aga, says the military will make sure all schools are safe before September 3rd, when the school year begins. He says soldiers will kill all rebels who fail to disarm and surrender.
We have got firm instructions from the hierarchy. We will shoot them right at their hideouts. This situation has to come to an end. We cannot accept that people cut roads, burn bridges, burn schools.
Cameroon says the rebels have torched more than 130 schools, while the separatists accuse the military of burning the schools to flush them out of hiding. The military has denied the accusation. For the past month, the government and civic society groups have called for the schools to reopen. Jude Mbaku, a campaigner for the Educate Them Now movement, says it is vital for both troops and rebels to consider schools no-go zones.
Belligerents of the crisis in the Northwest and the Southwest region are not doing enough to ensure the right to education. We call for ceasefire and stop all the attacks on educational structures, on learners, and on teachers.
The conflict in Cameroon's English-speaking region started in 2016 when teachers and lawyers protested the dominance of French language and officials in the bilingual country. Armed separatists in 2017 began demanding a separate English-speaking state, saying they would make the area ungovernable. More than 2,000 people, including soldiers and police, have been killed in mounting violence since. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bamenda, Northwestern Cameroon.
17 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. British Airways has cancelled flights to Egypt for a week, citing security concerns. Egyptian officials expressed displeasure over the unilateral decision, saying they had not been consulted. The suspension of the airline service to Cairo was announced as passengers at London's Heathrow Airport were preparing to board the daily flight Saturday. Extra Egyptair flights were carrying stranded passengers to London. German carrier Lufthansa also cancelled its flights from Frankfurt and Munich Saturday, but resumed service yesterday. Other major airlines continue to operate to and from Cairo. British Airways called its move a precaution and cited a security review for its decision. The British government also issued a travel warning for Egypt, citing a heightened risk of terrorism against aviation. Following a recent landmark ruling which decriminalized same-sex relations in Botswana, a leading human rights group has asked the government to provide condoms to prison inmates. Last month, Botswana became the first African country to decriminalize homosexual relations through the courts. From Habrone, Botswana, Mokandisi Dube reports.
In the wake of the June 11 Botswana High Court ruling decriminalizing same-sex relations, human rights group Botswana Network on Ethics, Law and HIV/AIDS, Bonela, has urged the government to provide condoms to prisoners. Previously, the government shot down the proposal, arguing anal sex was unlawful. But Bonela Executive Director Cindy Kelemi says the court judgment means prison inmates are allowed to engage in consensual same-sex relations.
For the longest time, government has refused to provide condoms to prisoners on the basis that their mode of, you know, sexual encounter is criminalized. So we because now the court had made a pronouncement, we engaged the commissioner by way of writing him a letter to say we want now to come and provide condoms to prisoners.
Botswana's Commission of Prison told Bonela that the government will look into the matter. The country's attorney general has indicated his intention to appeal the High Court judgment in a bid to reinstate parts of the penal code which criminalized same-sex relations. Under the colonial era laws, gays faced up to 7 years in jail if found engaging in same-sex conduct. Meanwhile, gay activists welcomed the High Court judgment, say the ruling has not generated public resentment. Gays are generally mistreated in some countries across the continent, but Mutswafere Sithole, one of the country's few openly gay public figures, says the environment in Botswana is different.
I said Botswana is really a peaceful country. Like, these laws were there, but then, you know, because we are humans first, I think people do not put as much effort into this because there's so many things that we can look at and to better the country, and that was at the least of the problem.
Mutswafere says instead of appealing the High Court ruling, the government's focus should be on moving on to legalize gay marriages.
After the decriminalization, I just feel like we should go straight into gay marriages, because I have a partner. I would want to spend the rest of my life with my partner, and I would want to celebrate it in my country first.
Mutswafere and other gay communities in Botswana face an anxious wait to hear the verdict of the Court of Appeal. The date for the appeal has not been set. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
The United Nations says Zimbabwe's food situation is moving from a crisis to an emergency. It says a majority of the population is food insecure because of El Nino-induced drought and the ongoing economic meltdown. Columbus Mavunga has more from a poor township just outside Harare.
The impoverished town of Epworth, less than an hour drive southeast of Harare, is one of the places in Zimbabwe in desperate need of food aid. 48-year-old Placidus Shibura says she's struggling to look after her grandchildren because of the harsh economic conditions in Zimbabwe. She says, "We have resorted to just one meal a day, and at times it's just the vegetables we get in our garden. We are struggling to get money to buy food. I wish donors would bring us food, especially for the children, as I'm not employed. Even school fees I can't pay. One of the children was not well, so medical bills are coming." According to a recent report by UN aid agencies and the government, Zimbabwe needs about $218 million to stave off hunger about 5.5 million people between now and April 2020, when the next harvest is expected. That's assuming there will be enough rains. Bishop Parajuli, the coordinator of UN agencies in Zimbabwe, is urging farmers to invest in irrigation and small grains as part of efforts to reduce the effects of climate. The World Body says Zimbabwe is among several Southern African nations hit by extreme weather in the 2018-2019 growing season. The drought has devastated crops, especially corn, which is used to make the staple food sadza, a thick porridge that is served with relish. In addition, Cyclone Idai in March destroyed many crops a few weeks before harvest time.
Unfortunately, we're moving from crisis to emergency, which is pretty serious. Also, the economic challenges facing the country. People have lost their income, and the situation is really precarious.
The drought has also affected the water supply. Michael Chideme, the spokesman for Harare, says two of the capital's reservoirs have dried out and others are following suit. Water rationing has begun. Parajuli says Zimbabwe is hoping and depending on the generosity of international community. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
And in more news from Zimbabwe, the government is ordering all new construction projects to be solar powered as part of measures to overcome the country's acute energy shortage. Rutendo Mawere reports from Harare.
Zimbabwe has been struggling to generate enough electricity to meet demand. Information Publicity and Broadcasting Services Minister Monica Mchangwa said solar power will help address the challenge.
It shall be mandatory for all new construction projects to be solar powered.
Chief Executive Officer of the Zimbabwe Building Contractors Association, Crispin Charayi, says the move will reduce the country's import bill.
So I think it's a good decision, it's an innovative decision, it's a welcome decision that we need to harness the natural power that we have. We are richly endowed in the sunshine, so we need to convert it into energy so that we can then manage our import bill.
However, Charai points out that solar equipment currently is sourced outside the country, so there will be challenges to use it.
I support that, but there's a challenge. Solar equipment is very expensive. Yeah, it's something that is very expensive to set up now, but then you then reap the benefits over the long term. So I can foresee a situation where very basic housing units for lowly paid workers in the country will become out of reach for them. But the idea is very noble. So I think what we then need to do to make sure that we then follow up on that government policy is to ensure that we then attract into the country investments that will then make the solar power equipment locally manufactured, including solar panels and the transformers and the regulators and so forth.
Charai says while this will add to the cost of construction, it is in line with global renewable energy trends encouraging green technology. Farai Maveza, an analyst, told VOA that buying solar equipment is cheaper than paying monthly bills to the Zimbabwe Electricity Distribution Company, CESA.
The cost element to solar energy is much cheaper than running hydroelectric power or any power that comes through CESA. Because through solar you just pay once, even if you are importing, but maybe it's just once. After that, the cost for maintaining are much cheaper than when you have to pay CESA, which you have to do every month. And you have to import power every month.
Zimbabwe has one hydropower plant, Kariba, and four coal-fired generators. The country has been suffering power cuts that last up to 18 hours in some areas due to lack of foreign currents to import energy and the low water levels in Kariba. ZESA is currently generating less than 800 megawatts against a demand of 1,500 megawatts. Reporting for VOA from Harare, this is Rutendo Mawere.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the African Continental Free Trade Area is now a reality that, if successful, will create a $3.4 trillion economic bloc. A closer look at Africa's free trade agreement on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports, or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.